question, the most insidious virus in the midst of this illegal downloading of music is piracy on the net.
Can you do that?
I got the latest tracks, we all know.
I know I ain't much, but you can have me for free.
And trends say it's going to promise to get much, much worse.
It's exciting and it's free.
Download.
I'm a Neil Diamond, Barry Manilow kind of girl, you know what I mean?
No request is too extreme.
Pop ends not with a bang, nor even a whimper, but quietly or loudly, homeless in the home. It's from the home, which is nowhere in sight unless it's your own, that the art of the bootleg mix appears, whereby anonymous raiders of the 20th century, or bastards, armed with a decent hard drive, a lust for life, a love of music that borders on the diseased, and a warped sense of humour, mash up tracks taken off the internet, twist genres across themselves, and rewrite musical history in a way musicians would never think of. Access on the internet to a cappella vocals and instrumental backing tracks means that homebodies, who are all in the mind, can ignore legalities and logic and all manner of niceties and splice together any music that takes their fancy. Destiny's Child's horny bootalicious is masked in with Nirvana's holy smells like teen spirit to create smells like booty. Right here and now, we're attempting to cram select slices of the last 100 years into an hour. Raiding the 20th century, just because we can, and because something I said 20 years ago sparked an idea in Strictly Kev's head. Right here and now, we're attempting to cram select slices of the last 100 years into an hour. Raiding the 20th century, just because we can, and because something I said 20 years ago sparked an idea in Strictly Kev's head.
You know, it doesn't carry on in a logical order, and then you come back in where you started.
What we're gonna do right here is go back.
I think we ought to learn just what this is all about.
I'll explain everything right from the beginning. Then it'll all be very clear.
Way back. Back into time.
What a view, huh? We got a good one today.
Yeah, nice.
Helen, you have your cassettes or CDs?
Yeah,
or?
I have CDs.
Great.
Should I assume people know I'm sitting in a room, or shouldn't I?
No.
I am sitting in a room different from the one you are in now. I am recording the sound of my speaking voice.
Alvin Lucia's I Am Sitting in a Room is an electroacoustic classic. I think it's a clue to the fact it exists, that it can be described as such, and also as a looping classic, as a minimalist classic. It is a cornerstone in the world of resonant frequencies, and I have seen it in numerous lists of important, influential music. Hopefully, by mentioning electroacoustic, resonant frequencies, minimalism and looping, you're beginning to see more of the decoration in the room that Lucia is sitting in. Listening to I Am Sitting in a Room, as I remember I once did, somewhere, somehow, in some way, made me think of the very beginning of time, even the time before time, if that was time. It made me think of a place where there was no space and no place for space. It slipped me back in time to when there was no time. As the sound of the piece developed, I drifted into the musical patterns that were forming as sound collapsed and reformed, and thought of how this musical story began at the absolute beginning of everything, when there was nothing but a beginning.
The story began in the 1940s with the invention of magnetic tape. The new possibilities offered by tape recording were soon being eagerly exploited by avant-garde composers, notably the Musique Concrète school in France.
The Rees, deserts. Like much of the new music of the time, it is totally tuneless. Ruiz dislikes the term music, preferring organised sound. The piece includes a number of tape sounds meant to be played back during the performance. The tape segments include factory noises recorded in sawmills in Philadelphia. This, in techno terms, is the first sample. Avant-garde exploitation of sound before the existence of the youth movement in music.
Now, these experiments started not on tape recorders, but on paper. In 1959, Brian Geisen applied the montage technique to words on a page. When you experiment with cut-ups over a period of time, you find that some of the cut-ups seem to refer to future events, suggesting that perhaps when you cut into the present, the future leaks out. The next step was cut-ups on the tape recorder. Now, the first tape recorder cut-ups were a simple extension of cut-ups on paper. You record, say, 10 minutes on the recorder. Then you spin the reel backwards or forwards, just like that, without recording. Stop at random and cut in a phrase.
How random is random?
Professor McLuhan.
Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively posed, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result.
In the grooves of this record is the sound of John Cage.
Medium of our time, electric circuitry, profoundly involves men with one another. Information pours information as soon as
during the 1960s, the work of electronic composers like Milton Babbitt was treated with great seriousness by the musical establishment.
Why is it that the kind of words one associates all too frequently with electronic music are words like bloop and bleep, aren't they?
More help in locating the sitting room that was the private space of Alvin Lucia will come from moving into the area occupied by Steve Reich's 1965 It's Gonna Rain. One Sunday afternoon, Reich, who had been experimenting extensively with tape loops since 1963, recorded Brother Walter, a black Pentecostal preacher who was speaking his thoughts on what would happen at the end of the world. Walter's voice was highly musical, and his sermon was almost chanted or sung. Reich made two loops of the same material. By accident, because of small motor variations in the speed of the two tape recorders, Reich discovered what happens when two identical tape loops gradually fall out of sync from each other. In the first part of It's Gonna Rain, he looped the two recordings of the voice together, moved them out of phase with each other, slipped them back in unison again. In the second part, he used loops of a longer length. Thus what starts out as a two-voice sound becomes four voices, with one pair out of phase with another pair. Finally, it breaks into eight parts. And the effect is, as Reich described, a kind of controlled chaos, which may be appropriate to the subject matter, the end of the world.
Cut up, slow down, speed up, run backwards, play several tracks at once.
What are you doing?
I mean, why don't we use plastic things?
Of course, when you cut in that phrase, you've wiped out what's ever there, and you have a new juxtaposition.
Good bread.
Because I was making, $2.71 an hour.
Now, how random is random? We know so much that we don't consciously know that we know that perhaps the cut-in was not random.
Mommy, I'm hungry.
I did it. I'm sitting in a room in 1969.
The first piece I made that I felt had something to do with that was called I'm Sitting in a Room, where I recycled speech, recorded speech in a room and then played it back into the room and made a recording of that and played it back into the room. Pretty soon the room acoustics, that's all you're going to hear at the end of the piece. So it's really the space in the room that makes the sound.
So it was that the Radiophonic Workshop officially came into being on April 1st, 1958, located in cramped quarters within the vast BBC building at Maida Vale.
We had this commission to do Major Bloodnot's stomach, and it was a loud explosion and fairly bodily function noises.
The musicians of the Radiophonic Workshop somehow produced sounds that, for a generation of British television viewers, symbolised the future.
Now here are some tapes made with all the technical facilities of the BBC in London, and they show, I think, what can be done within one phrase.
And the number nine was an engineer's voice. You know, they have test tapes, and her voice was saying, "This is number nine megacycles." So he was talking like that, and I just like the way he said number nine.
Number nine.
When I was mixing the record, I just had a radio in the room that was tuned to some BBC channel all the time, and we did about, I don't know, half a dozen mixes, and I just used whatever was coming through at the time. I never knew it was King Lear until years later somebody told me, because I could hardly make out what he was saying. It was interesting to mix the whole thing with a live radio coming through it.
How much of Revolution No. 9 was accidental?
Well, it's like an action painting. I had a lot of loops, tape loops, which is just a circle of tape. People don't understand it, it repeats itself over and over. Had about 10 of them on different mono machines, all spinning at once with pencils and things on them. I had a basic track, which was the end of the Revolution song, and I just played it sort of live into another tape and just brought them in on faders, like you do as a DJ, and brought them in like that. And it was accidental in that way. I think I did it twice, maybe, and the second one was the take.
Right. Oh, that's very good. Thank you, John. Run back the tape, please, Richard.
There's several days' work on that tape. For perhaps the 100th time, the engineer runs it back to the start for yet another stage in the making of an almost certain hit record.
All over hits.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time?
He's Mr. Know-It-All.
Did you ever see starlight come rushing from the sky?
It's going big enough for the both of us.
My name's Kenny Everett.
Hello?
Kenny Everett. And this record you're hearing is an advertisement for Wireless Workshop. Conveniently situated next to the bedroom in my flat, it is a complete and sophisticated radio production studio capable of making jingles. Oh, by the way, we do sound effects as well.
Hey, Bob.
Yes?
To which station are you tuned to?
I'm tuned to Capital.
Really?
They're cuddly.
Try us in VHF. We're even cuddlier.
And now, it's time for a break.
By the early 1970s, techniques of tape manipulation were being superseded.
I used to come home from school and used to go in the room and practice a lot. This particular day, I was playing the music a little bit too loud. And my mom came and, you know, banged on the door. And when she was banging on the door, I was, you know, still playing the music. So when she opened the door, I cut the music down. So I was still holding the record, moving it back and forth, you know? And then I thought about it. I said, well, this really sounded like something, you know? Interjecting another record with another record. So as time went by, you know, I experimented with it and used different records and practiced it, and it became scratch.
The official adventures of the Grandmaster Flash.
I'm here with my very special guest, Grandmaster Flash.
How you doing?
And what is it that you are first at?
I was first at taking a passage of music off vinyl.
which unjustifiably was the shortest part of the record. We used to call it the Get Down part, but then it became known as the break. I would take duplicate copies of a record and take this break that was sometimes 8 to 10 seconds long and extend it seamlessly to the beat to 25 minutes if I wanted to, you know, or manipulating the break or like taking that particular passage and rearranging the arrangement, rubbing the record back and forth here, this, that, playing around with the vinyl, so to speak.
Certain DJs had come before you who were tremendous influences. Who were those DJs who influenced you the most?
Well, I'd say Kool Herc was one. This gentleman by the name of DJ Jones, who was big on the disco side of DJ, you know. Mm-hmm. He was a great blender. He would blend from one record carefully to the next. There were three people who were sort of in control of the Bronx. It was, you know, Flash in the one area, Kool Herc in one area, Sam Bada in the other.
You're listening to Some Assembly Required. My name is John. If you're just tuning in, our featured artist this episode is Steinsky. I spoke with Steinsky about the art of appropriation.
I called up one or two people at CBS, and I sort of delineated the project for them. And they, out of hand, they just went, wow, you know, we, good luck, buddy. You'll never get that kind of permission from us. And so I thought, ah, the hell with it, so I'll just do it.
And they just, they laughed at you, it sounds like.
Well, yeah. Well, I would too if I was them.
Well, yeah, but isn't it arguable that given the media's involvement in making that occurrence such a public one, that we should be allowed to use the media to express our own personal experiences of the event?
Nope.
You don't think so?
I don't buy it. Hell no, man. I mean, if I own the copyright to Walter Cronkite, that's mine. Period. Forget it.
Okay, so you respect copyright.
Well, I respect it in theory. I obviously don't respect it in fact.
How do you justify that, then?
I don't. This is what I do, man. God put me on earth to make these records. You know, so the rest is all commentary. I'm going to make the records. I don't even think about it too much, to tell you the truth.
Some bootleggers, who are actually more librarians of lunacy, cram 100 intros from songs into 12 minutes, recognizing that no one has the time to listen to everything unless it is processed into an abbreviated form of excitement that performs its nostalgia fast, so you don't have to leave the present for too long, which is never a particularly good idea.
Out of control, and it's also criminal.